Good evening, everybody. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic. Whew, quarter, finally got some sense. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, for that kind introduction. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober, and I love God, and I don't apologize for any of the three. You know, and it used to be I'd always have to apologize for one of those three, but of course, you guys understand that. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank John for calling me however long ago it was. And somebody had called me a couple years ago. It was Amy, I believe it was, and I couldn't make it. And I'm just delighted to be here. And I want to congratulate everybody that's here and worked so hard to put this together, especially you that don't think you're appreciated for all the things you did this weekend. We want to thank you especially. And I want to thank my friend Ed here from the California group for having more sobriety than me, you know. Well, I don't like getting that close. I always like to be in the front of the line, but not that line. And so I'm glad Ed's here and got 37 years because, you know, I've always been told two Eds are better than one. That's the kind of night it's going to be, huh? Yeah, bad. I've always been told that whenever you're asked to speak somewhere, there's one person in particular you came to talk to, and I believe I already talked to that person or persons, but if not, listen up, because I want to share with you the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous that changed me from a man or a child who was so angry and so mad that he wouldn't let anybody close, to a person who can't get people close enough. I want to tell you that I love you, and I love you with all my heart. And you may not understand that, but I do. And that's what's important. And you know something? What anybody thinks of me is none of my concern. My concern is what I think of you. And if there's anything in my life that'll ever add to yours, allow me to give that to you. Because of your kindness and your grace, I'm standing here the man I always wanted to be. You might have noticed I'm tall. People did pretty good up until today. You know, and it's always the same question. Oh, how's the weather up there? And I used to say, how is it down around my, as you can imagine? And now I just say, heavenly, thank you. You know, isn't it? I was thinking, this is kind of a demonstration of Al-Anon. A good Al-Anon would go, right? Good AA would go. Never did know the need for them caps. But I'm usually asked the same two questions by the same sized person. The same first question is,
oh, how tall are you?
And I say 6'10". They say,
oh, do you play basketball?
And I say, no, how tall are you? And they say, 5'6". And I say, oh, do you play miniature golf? Seems to be fair. They made up the rules. I'm just trying to get along. I used to think I had to do things to get attention. My favorite though was I was out in Beverly Hills one day and there was this woman that was annoyed because I was tall. People do that. And, you know, like you're breathing.
Oh, stop it.
But I'm in this grocery line and this woman looks behind me and said,
what, do you play basketball? And I said, no. And she said, well, why not?
And I said, I had a drinking problem from a very early age, and I didn't realize I was this tall till I got sober. You laugh. She went, huh? What? Of course, I got that look all my life. Huh? What? I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and you know, it's difficult when you have a position in the community, but work, work, work to keep it, you know, and we certainly did, and I laugh and joke about that now, but I also need to tell you that was the toughest thing for me to shake once I got sober. You see, because when I got here, I was dirty on the inside where soap wouldn't reach. And I thought you didn't understand. And I would shower and I would shower, but I wouldn't be clean. And through the grace of God and the fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm as clean today on the inside as I am on the outside. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. I've got a brother who's 44 years sober. He's been sober so long we won't let people smoke around him. He might go up in flames. You know. But he took me to an ANA meeting, a place called Blandine in Davenport, Iowa. And I remember I walked in there and there was some old guy up here about 30, you know.
And he's going, "My name's Fred and I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, "Good for you, Fred, you know. I get old and burn out, I'll be here too."
Well, here I am. I didn't realize I was a prophet at that point. It took me a few years. But the only reason I mention that is because I went back out. I knew about AA. I was exposed to AA. And it meant absolutely nothing to me. Because my problems were the same as your problems, I'm assuming. Already at 10 years old, it was what might have been's, if onlys. And leave me alone. I started drinking at a real early age. I don't know how old I was. Dad used to think it was funny to get me drunk. And it started out, I'd go to the refrigerator to get him a beer, and he'd give me a sip for go getting beer. Well, he drank a lot. And as I kept going and getting bigger, the sips got bigger. Pretty soon it was two beers. It wasn't a big deal. And Dad used to think it was funny to get the little kid drunk. And I'm not saying that's a bad rap, Dad. That's what his dad did. That's what they did then. So I don't know when I took my first drink, but I know this, that very early in my life, it got to the point of I'd rather have something in me than nothing in me. Because already I had found out something, and it was my deep, dark secret. There's something seriously wrong with me. I look at you, and you look different than me. I watch the way you function in this world, and at young age, I already knew I'm different. And when I drank, my difference didn't matter so much. Clancy always says when he drank, it went boom. And, you know, and for me, it took the edge off of everything. I could breathe. I could breathe, and I got tough. I've got a brother, God bless him. He was a mean man. He was tough. You know, he wasn't one of them. He'd never threaten you. You'd hear gunshots is what you'd hear if he was mad at you. And he did a lot of hard time, and he had created a reputation. And I was handed that reputation. It wasn't comfortable. I was 2 and 3 years sober before when squealing tires would stop beside me that I wouldn't either hit the floor or turn around and punch who's ever in back of me. That's the way it was when I was sober. When I was loaded, I'd casually turn around. "What's up, Doc?" You know. And I'm one of those two. I am a firm believer in singleness and purpose. I also need to tell you I took more drugs than most people who call themselves drug addicts. But that's just a part of my story. I am an alcoholic, and that is sufficient unto my disease. I am the type of person that if I'm not working this program in every area of my life, whatever area of my life that I'm not working in will be my next program, I promise you. I promise you. You know, we always think we're so different. I remember years ago, there was we all got our standards, things we wouldn't do and turn our nose up to. And there was a football player in Los Angeles, and he got arrested for exposing himself to children. And he got arrested and was with the Rams at the time. And man, there was a lot of bad press, and there was a lot of bad stuff going on about it. And they cut him slack. He was married to a famous actress, so they give him another chance. And a few months later, he did it again. He exposed himself to those little girls, and he lost his career and divorced and disgraced. And I was down at my sponsor's office, and this guy happened to be there doing some community service. And my sponsor introduced me as an recovering alcoholic and introduced me to him, and we're sitting there talking. And my sponsor left the office for a minute. And the guy turned to me, he said, "You know, I have a problem exposing myself to children." I said, "Yeah, I don't know a lot about that." He said, "Oh, I thought you said you were alcoholic." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, you know nothing about having a compulsion to do something. And if you do it, it'll cost you everything you ever loved, and you do it anyway. you wouldn't know anything about that, would you? And I apologized. Anything I hate, I can relate to. And I don't ever want to forget that. I am not above anything if I'm not working this program. I am not above anything. And I'm real grateful for lessons like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 13 years old, I was arrested by the highway patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun. I had already gotten to the point if anybody was going to hurt feelings, it might as well be me hurting yours. And I didn't know a lot about guns, but I'll tell you one thing. I knew I whipped that bad boy out, people moved. Especially if I'd crack one of them off. Highway patrolman pulled me over and said, "What do you do with that gun?" And I am ignorant about guns, still am. He said, "What are you doing with this gun?" And I said, "Go rabbit hunting." And he looked at me and said, "What do you do, run them down and beat them to death? Is that what you do?" They threw me in the hole that night to teach me what jail was like, because they knew my brother. And they taught me a lesson. They'd never take me in there without a fight again, is what they taught me. Won't happen. Won't happen. So not only that, I became a cop fighter. Any other cop fighters here? There you go. Couple. I found out something. I'll just share it with you. Do what you want. There's always more of them. Just kind of missed that detail. Just, there's always more of them. Yeah. But I was geared, you know, if I saw a badge, I swung. I don't care if you were crossing guard, I'd take you out, you know. And, God, we had a lot of fun. Wasn't drinking fun? Yeah, I like that. And I like Mad Dog 2020, Ariba wine. And my drug history is simply this. I can never remember saying, "Oh, what will this do to you?" Mine was, "Guy Moore? Guy Moore?" That's all I knew, because the one thing I wanted to do was stay out of it. The one thing I didn't want to do is ever feel again. Now, they lied to me when I come to AA. They always say nobody lies to you in AA. Yeah, they do. They lied to me. They said to me, "You keep drinking and using, you're going to die." And I thought, excellent. Where do I sign up? Because if I wanted to live, do you think I'd be drinking like that? And I thought they said they were going to restore my life, and I said, "No thanks. Who wants this mess?" To this day, I've never told anybody I'm working with, "If you keep it up, if you keep drinking and using, you're going to die." I tell them, "You know, you keep this up, you may live a very long time. Forever, maybe." You know? Great. I got kicked out of school when I was 13 years old. Seems they had a problem with subordinates. No, actually, I had a problem with authority, I guess you'd put it. And it's been said here several times this weekend, if you told me no, it's, "Oh, yeah, we'll see." You know, my mother, God bless her, I can remember reducing her to tears not once, not twice, but thousands of times. When she'd tell me no, I'd stay on it till she'd say, "For Christ's sake, Ed, just do it and leave me alone." Okay, Mom. I won. I got kicked out of school. I went home and Dad threw me up against the wall and started beating on me. Now, you got to understand, that's how it was at that time. That wasn't abuse. That was trying to get my attention. And he was beating away on me, and he got done. And I looked at him and said, "You finished?" And I brought tears to his eyes, and I thought, broke him. That's the kind of kid I was. You know, a lot of times we bad rap alcoholism and drug addiction. I was a jerk long before I got it. I had the gift. It was always all about me and what I wanted and when I wanted it. I always had the gift. And it almost killed me. Another gift I got when I was real young was, I could walk into a room with 300 people, 299 could turn around to me and say, "Ed, you're the best." we love you. And one could turn around and go, you jerk. Guess who I remembered? And I know you're not this sick, but it got to the point in my life where the 299 didn't even exist anymore. It was just the ones. I can remember going to church. Oh, that was fun. All ministers have thin blue lips, talk like this. Ministers and priests, I hear. And they'd always single me out. They'd always say, you're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell. And I think, how do you know I've only been here 20 minutes? And I remember there was one guy who sat up front in church, and he had thin blue lips too. They all do. And he was looking so hoity-toity. And I thought to myself, you know, he looked like he was having a lot more fun in the bar last night, personally. And I don't know who that grumpy's sitting with today, but she seemed to be a lot more fun last night, too. And you know what I thought? Hypocrites. Now, I know you're not this way or this sick, but I didn't only judge that one man or that pew or that church. I judged entire organized religion by my limited experience and threw the whole church out. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I've got my ones. And they brought, they talked about God, and please believe me, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but my belief at that time was God was a punk. And if he come down, I'd beat the sheet off of him. And I said it often and sincerely. Because if there's a God, why would he let me go through everything I've been through? Why would he put my mom through all this years of crap? And no food in the house and kids going to prisons and a drunken husband that beat on her from time to time. You want to talk about God? Show me where he's at in my house. And those are the ones I'd collected about God. And I'd been taught some bad information. Now, you got to remember, I'm the collector of information. My cousin, when I was 10 years old, Linda, if there was anybody ever close to God, it was Linda. And she did everything right. She was beautiful. She was an honor student. She just made me sick. She just, good grades, everything, goody two shoes. And I just adored her. I wouldn't talk to her, but I adored her. And one day she's walking across the street and a truck comes by and hits and kills her. And knocks her 200 feet. And I remember going to the funeral, and you know what people said? Honest to God, what they said? God must have wanted an angel. And I thought, so he hits you with a truck. I'll pass. I'd just soon burn, personally. Still feel that way. As a matter of fact. But those are the ones I carried. And I'd been around A&A, and I thought, you know, it was for other folks. And there wasn't a whole lot I hadn't done in my youth. And the only thing I hadn't done is probably things I don't remember doing. Because I drank to be excluded from this universe. I never drank to fit in. Who'd want to fit in with you? I hated two types of people, living ones and dead ones. Everybody else was okay. Pretty much left me. But, I joke about it, but it was really true, and I was angry and angry, and drinking saved my life. Drinking saved my life, and saved a lot of others, too. By my hand or not by my hand, you know. I used to... With a cop fighter, I always hoped they'd take me out. Then I could be a hero in the neighborhood, you know. Imagine my surprise when January 5th of 1971, when I'm 20 years old, just turned 20, and I'm driving down the street and I'm in a car wreck. Now, that's not unusual because I was in a car wreck about once a week. Good news is I wasn't driving for once. That was good. And I hit my head pretty bad and had a brain concussion and was laying in the middle of the street, and it's 18 below zero, And I'm pretending like I'm knocked out. I'm not sure why it seemed like the thing to do at the time. And I hear the police come up. And they say, that's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth. Don't even cover that SOB. Car's probably hot. He's just a punk. An amazing thing happened. I agreed. I'm a cop fighter. Those are fighting words. And that night, I agreed. I love what Howard said. That was not my lowest point. Not physically, not mentally, not emotionally, not spiritually, but that night, I agreed. And for some reason, it was perfectly clear to me that I was there as the result of my best thinking. My best ideas put me in the middle of that street in every other jam I'd ever been in. It really didn't matter what neighborhood I was brought up in, what education I did or did not have, whether I was molested as a child or not. I was, and I enjoyed it. Sorry. I always hear this, oh, traumatic. There was a neighborhood lady who taught me. I still look for her from time to time. Wonder if she's... I suppose that's a bad thing to say, but it's the truth. But those are the things that went on in me that I couldn't talk about. It's like my inventory. I don't know where you're going with this stuff. It's like my inventory. I remember when I started to write my inventory, I had a piece of paper, and I was in a room by myself, and I was just a few months sober, and I wrote down, my mother is a fat pig and she stinks and I hate her. And I was in the room alone and I covered it with both hands and I cried. Because we all know you're not supposed to feel that way. But I did. But I did. Haven't felt that way since. But I did then. You know. If I'm going to get better, I got to tell the truth about how I feel. That night, they took me up to the hospital. The police took me up to the hospital and admitted me to Mercy Hospital and rolled me by some nurse. And I don't know if I've ever seen her before or since. She knew me. I was well known. And she said, Ed, do you want me to call AA? And I went, might as well. Now, us old-timers want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days. You know? Might as well. And I'm sitting there, and anybody with wine connoisseurs, you know the better stuff. Mad Dog, 2020, Ariba, stuff. That's the kind of stuff I was drinking that night. And the next morning, you ever had that dry heaves? Oh, yeah, you know, from the toes. It was a fun morning. Drinking's fun. And I was in there praying at the porcelain altar and come out and got back in my bed. And this guy come in, had a smile on his face. Named Hap, short for Happy. And he's from A&A. And he says, hi, Ed, my name's Hap. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, get out of my room. But I didn't say that. I said, hi, Hap, because I'd met Hap before. And he said, we don't drink and we don't use one day at a time. And I don't know why I got honest that day, except it was time. And I looked at him and I said, you don't seem to understand. I can't make it a whole day without something. I'd really like to, but I can't. That honesty came from a place where I'd never lived before. And Hap looked at me and said, well, Ed, all you have to do is try. And that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this, is try. And that's all that's required. Sometimes I've tried greatly and sometimes I've tried poorly. But each and every day I try to be a better person than I was yesterday. Instinctively, I knew I had to start going to meetings. Instinctively, I knew I had to keep busy. Thank you, God. Because I knew if I took a minute to think, everybody was in trouble, including me. And I just kept busy. I'd started going to meetings, and I'd go to meetings day in and day out. Are there any other shakers here? Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love good shakers. You don't get many good shakers anymore. I mean, you know, they just pill them up so bad. It's just sad. You know... Hi, are you new? Guess so. And I really think if they let them feel it a little better, they'd get the point because I was a shaker, man. Jeez. How you doing? That all good. How are you? Nice to see you. Coffee? No, thanks. Jeez. Piece of cake? No, can't have sharp objects. Oh, you know. And my arms are just dull, you know. And I'm sitting at meetings having coffee, clinking against the teeth, you know. And they only give me that much. Thank you, God. And I had two rules, just two rules. Don't come up behind me and don't touch me. You know? And thank God I had an old friend, Harry. Harry didn't know my rules. And Harry was the coffee pourer. And Harry'd come up behind me, pour coffee. And he'd put his hand right here. And he'd pour some coffee. And a calmness would come over me that I'd never known before. A peace and a calmness. And I could breathe. And the madness stopped. And everything was okay. And then Harry'd leave. And it'd start again. And I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. So Harry'd come back. And just put his hand here. And make it stop. Make it stop. Thank God Harry didn't care about my rules. Thank God for the touch of unconditional love. It's the reason I'm breathing tonight. And I wasn't very touchable, and I wasn't very lovable, and I smelled awfully bad. And Harry just loved me. And he always put his hand on me. It's important what we say to new people in AA. It really is. Years later, I was in a suicidal depression. I had been diagnosed manic depressive long before it was fashionable. And the only thing I've ever done is work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a depression in a number of years. I know that upsets some people. Just pray for me. Sorry about that. I was in one of those black spots, you know, and you know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about, and it was stark raving sober. And my plan was, I'm going to go to my sponsor's house, turn on his gas coffee pots, not light them, just lay down and go to sleep. That's my plan. And I stopped by the AA club, and there's a guy named Jimmy there, and Jimmy was from Texas. Jimmy was a rapid-fire talker. He'd give you three talks in time one. He'd rub his hands together like this. You know what I mean? He'd just rapid-fire talk to you. He'd tell you everything you want to know and twice do it, you know? One day he said, I asked some psychologist why I rub my hands together like this. He told me, I smacked him right in the mouth, you know? That was Jimmy. He was rapid-fire. And I walk into the club that day, and I walk up to Jimmy, and if he did it once, he did it 100 times, and if he did it to anybody else, I don't care. But here's what he said to me. Remember my plan. I'm going to go home and turn on the gas. And I walked by Jimmy and I said, Hi, Jimmy, how are you today? And it was like the world stopped. And I swear it felt like he took my face in his hands. He didn't, but it felt like it. And I'd say, Hi, Jimmy, how are you? And he'd say, I'm much better for seeing you, my friend. I'm much better for seeing you. Saved my life. Because I thought, well, if Jimmy likes me, maybe I got it all wrong. Maybe I got it backwards. I'll kill myself tomorrow. Keep coming back. It's important what we say. It's important what we do to new people and old people in AA, the used people. You know, I'll tell you what, we're losing people out of both ends quicker than we ever have. Last year, for the first year ever, AA membership flatlined. It's never done that before. We're losing more people than ever. Why, in my opinion, is because we've forgotten or never known what Alcoholics Anonymous is. They've turned it into psychobabble. They've turned it into group. They've turned it into Medication Anonymous. And that's not what this is about. It's just not what this is about. I remember I was sitting there one day and had my feet up on the desk, and an old-timer, Logan, we buried him with 56 years. Logan came into the club, and I had my feet up, had my own key to the club now. And he said, "You think you got all the answers, don't you, kid?" And I said, "No, but I was thinking, yep, pretty much got this wrapped up." And he said, "Let me tell you something." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I was young once, but you've never been old." It is the first time I ever entertained the possibility that you have felt the way I feel. Maybe, just maybe, all these feelings aren't original unto me. From that day to this, I respect Old Timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really not here to judge whether their sobriety's up to my standards or not. I just thank God they were chopping weeds so I could talk about them. You know? They were out there chopping weeds so you and I could be here, and this room is full with beautiful people tonight. So I thank God for the Old Timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope we start keeping more of the newcomers. And I hope we start talking about what AA is rather than what might be more convenient to do. And I went to a lot of meetings, and you know, it was just a matter of time before they brought up that three-letter word. Oh, man. I remember the day I was sitting in the meeting, and they brought it up. They just talked about it openly. Job. That was vulgar. And I really got annoyed with that, you know. And they said, "Ed, you got to get a job." And I said, "Look, I'll cut down on my stealing. I'll just do enough to make ends meet." Moderation, right? Isn't that what we need? Moderation, you know. But they said, no, not only do you have to quit stealing, you got to do something more difficult, most difficult thing you've ever done. That's start telling me the way you really feel rather than what I want you to know. And how do I feel? God, that was a foreign country. I hadn't been there in so many years. And some of the other speakers talked about it so eloquently, about lying so well. I would lie when the truth had served me better. I don't know why. I just kind of, and a long time after I got sober, I would kind of embellish just for the heck of it. And I had to stop that. And here's how I stopped it. I'd start telling somebody something, and if I was lying or embellishing, I'd have to stop and say, "I'm sorry, that's a lie. We need to back up about 5 sentences. And start again, if you don't mind." And sometimes I'd have to restart a time or two, because by God, the lie was a good one. It was a perfectly good lie. And I couldn't do that. You told me that, and I believed you, thank God. And I went to a lot of meetings. And there was a Catholic priest sober in our group, Father Tom. And Father Tom said to me one day, thin blue lips, they all happen, "Well, Ed, why don't you come back to church?" And I had the honesty part of the program. At about 6 months, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it. I'd suggest you wait for the 8 months personally, but I didn't know that. And he said, "Ed, why don't you come back to church?" I said, "I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars." Felt pretty good about telling him, too. He looked back at me and said, "Well, Ed, why don't you come? One more won't hurt." I punished him. I didn't talk to him for a month or two. Tell me the truth. Amazing year. And of course, they started talking about God, and that I was violently anti-religious. I don't say that with pride. I say that with sadness, because I remember the pain I was in and the loneliness that caused and the isolation I felt. But that's where I was. I just had this knot in my gut. If anybody brought up that crap, I'd turn over the table. I'd just, man. And people said to me, "You know, Ed," and thank God they told me this, because you don't hear it much anymore. In fact, in Iowa, they're not even allowed to mention God in a lot of treatment centers anymore. That's special. But they told me, "Ed, if you're going to stay sober, you've got to develop a relationship with the God of your own understanding. It's necessary, and it's the only way you'll ever stay sober on an all-time basis." And that was bad news. Then they give me the good news. They said, "Okay, Ed, you can have a God of your very own." And I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "You can make up your own." I thought, cool. You know, so I thought long and hard about this one. You know, if you're making up God, it's got to be a good one. And I thought, and I came up with, my God's going to be kind and loving and forgiving. Said, how do you like that? They didn't seem to mind at all. You see, that was 180 degrees from anything I ever knew about God, because I am a collector of ones. And they told me that was okay and I could do that. And I like that. I like that. Now that's the kind of God I can hang around. But I made a mistake my first year sober, and I see a lot of other people make it. I started professing a faith I didn't have. I didn't mean to. Honest to God, I didn't mean to. I was just around you people, and you made me feel, it was good feelings. I didn't know what they were for a long time, because all that stuff had been so, Andrea said it so eloquently about, you know, being able to identify feelings after you get sober. But you made me feel so good. And I lost my track. Suppose I should have wrote out my talk, huh, Howard? But I really did. I lost my place. Don't know where I was at. I'll have to start over. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. That's the trouble with these canned talks. You just kind of... But I started professing a faith that I didn't have. There were well-meaning people there who would talk about God. And I'd look in their eyes, and when they talk about... And believe me, eyes are the mirror of the soul. When I ask you how you're doing, I ain't looking at your feet, baby. I'm looking you right in the eye. Because the eyes are the mirror of the soul. And when these people would talk about God, I'd look at them and they meant it. There was something really there. I didn't quite get their angle and how they were working it. But there was something there. And they would say amazing things. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. You know, easy does it. I like that. I took it so easy they had to remind me to breathe every now and then, you know. But I started professing these spiritual profundities that I hear from time to time in meetings from new people. And the sad part is there's a trace of truth in all of it, but they don't have the emotional maturity to handle that spiritual knowledge yet. And that's right where I was at. And I didn't know it. And the reasons it's important for me to share this with you is there will be a time in your life when all that's going to stand between you and everything you've ever loved is your God. And it better be the truth. Better be the truth. My truth came shortly thereafter. I just over a little over a year sober. And my dad asked me over to the house. And it's unusual for dad to ask me over to the house unless I'm in trouble. So... You know, he asked me over, so I'd hung around you guys, and you told me I had to bring new attitudes into my home front if I wanted new attitudes. It wasn't waiting for them to change. I had to change. And so I suited up, and I showed up, and I went over to their dad's house, mom and dad's house, for supper. And we got about halfway through supper, and dad said, boy, and I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. I said, yeah, Pop. And he said, just wanted to tell you I'm really proud of you. When we get sober, they tell us miracles will take place in our lives, and I'm here to testify that that indeed is true. However, that statement from my father wouldn't even been on the list of miracles. Yet he looked me right in the eye for the first time I can ever remember, and he told me he was proud of me. Had you hooked a lie detector up to me that night when I went into that house? On my entering, if you said to me, do you care what your old man thinks? I would have said no, and it would have said true. How grateful I am I've been so horribly wrong about so many things in my life. And you've taught me the right way. Man, that was a good night. And I went to a meeting and afterwards, and then went to my sister-in-law's, and my mother called, and she was crying and hysterical. And she said, Ed, come home quick. And I said, Mom, what's wrong? She said, I don't know, Eddie. Dad went across the street to get a quart of beer for him and a bottle of pop for me, and now they're carrying bodies out, and police are everywhere. Come home, please. And it was one of those ice storm nights, you know, where you get a quarter-inch ice over everything, and it's just nasty out. And I'm thinking, well, all's God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. I'm okay. Can't be anything bad happen to me now that I got God. And I'm here to tell you that bad things can happen to you after you get God, and God is your answer. But I didn't know that then. All I had was other people's words and very little experience. I pulled up to that bar where I drank since I was 11 years old. And I spent a lot of nights in there, and I saw more police than I'd have ever seen anywhere. Funny how they'd shaped up that year I was sober. No, really, you know, you don't talk about their heritage, they usually don't talk about yours either. You don't swing at them, they usually don't swing back. It was an amazing thing. And I'd also worked in the courts that year with Alcoholics Anonymous. We used to have a wonderful relationship with the courts where we could just go in. If somebody came in with an alcohol or drug problem, they'd just give them to us. Say, bring them back in 30 days and tell us what you think. And people were getting sober left and right, and still sober to this day left and right. But the cops knew that I'd been sober. And I walked into that bar, and there was an officer there and said, Ed, what are you doing here? And I said, my old man was in here. He said, oh, my God, Ed. And I said, why? What's wrong? He said, Ed, all we can tell you is somebody came in and opened fire and shot everybody. And I looked down the bar, and I saw that pool of blood with my father's glasses all mangled up in the middle of it. And I got real sad because I didn't want to know that information. That's the kind of information I just don't want to know. That's why I drink. I don't want to know. And I turned to him and I said, what do I do? And he said, Ed, all the bodies have been taken up to the hospital. Some are dead, some are alive. Go up there. So I drove up to the hospital and I went in there, and there was a lieutenant in there that hadn't forgotten my past. And I walked up to him and he said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I just come up to see if my dad was in that shamrock. He said, I've identified all the bodies in there. And none of them are your old man. Now you get out of here before we run your butt. And he was vulgar and he was nasty and he was just mean. And he said, you get out of here before we run you in. And an amazing miracle happened. I looked at him and said, okay. A year and a half before that, they would have been looking for a new lieutenant because nobody talks to me that way. Nobody. And I left. And I went home and I called the one officer that for the last 5 years of my drinking tried his best to put me away. By God's grace, he did. It certainly wasn't my skill. But I knew he knew I was sober. And I trusted him because he could have set me up a number of times and never did. He was going to catch me straight up and he'd tell me. That's the guy I called, Bob Garner. And he said, Ed, what are you doing? And I said, Bob, my dad was in the Shamrock Tavern. He said, oh, my God, Ed, hold on. And he fed me information. Now, you know he ain't supposed to do that. But he knew there was a lot on the line for me that night. He knew. And he talked to me for a while, and the only thing we could come up with is he either got shot and wandered outside or they took him as a hostage. So we formed a search party, and we searched the streets all night. And I'd always wished you wouldn't know that kind of pain and that kind of sadness. And then Oklahoma City happened. Then September 11th happened. And we all knew needless homicide. Because when that happens to you, it gives you a set of emotions that are so strong all at once. And you just want to scream, you want to cry, you want to kill, you want to hug. You just want to explode. And I walked those streets all night, and the only thing that would come to mind is the Serenity Prayer. One word at a time, because that's about all I could handle. Next morning, that officer called up from the hospital and said, well, Ed, you want to come up and identify your old man? Anybody could have made a mistake. And I said, okay. And I went up there, and I walked into that morgue and saw my dad laying there with that bullet hole in his face. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing and came up with absolutely nothing. Because none of it was my experience. I don't know that I've ever been that sad or alone or felt that isolated before in my life. I hear people say from time to time, you know, my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. Not my experience. Because I had something in my system all the time. And this is a reality that I'd never experienced and never wanted to. I remember I never felt so lonely, so afraid, as sitting in that morgue, and I opened the door and there were some friends from AA and Al-Anon out there, and they kind of winked and they just looked me right in the eye and told me it was okay. Because you see, that's my God, taking care of me where I cannot take care of myself. And he sent you everywhere I went. Everywhere I went, there was some member of AA who was right there. And you guys carried me when I could not carry myself. And I remember going to the funeral, and the priest that did the funeral said something that gave me one of the keys to the kingdom. During the funeral, he said, "You know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will." He said, "I don't believe that." And I sat right up in my pew. He said, "God created human beings and gave us all a free will. Those human beings chose to do this act, and now it's God's will." And it was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. Because I had the same stuff a lot of you had. Well, if there's a God, why are there starving children in the world? Why do we got millions of babies starving? It's real simple. We're busy driving our new cars and buying cell phones and not feeding them. Don't you blame God ever again. He gave us more than enough to share. We just don't. You know? Why is everybody dying of cancer? Because we pollute everything we touch and want to blame everybody else. Must be them. And I've come to believe that God cries worse than all of us. Had a tough couple weeks here before I came here. 2 weeks ago, a young man I met about 4 years ago when he was 20 years old came back from Arizona where he'd been at college, and he got a hold of some hallucinogenic, some mushroom, and it just tilted him forever. He was never right. And I used to spend a lot of time with him and take him to meetings, and he'd just go off into never-never land. And they put him on all kinds of medications, which this particular guy needed, because he was just not right. And he couldn't take it on the meds. He couldn't take it. About a week and a half ago, he committed suicide. 24 years old. Walked into the river because he just couldn't take it anymore. A week ago last night, a little friend of mine who was celebrating his 17th birthday, who's been in and out of the program, was doing pretty good. He'd gotten his grades all back up, and Mom and Dad were pleased. They knew when he was going to be home and he'd call. And he's driving home when a drunk driver swung across 5 lanes and hit him head on and killed him. And I did his funeral Wednesday. And there were thousands of people there. But I can tell you this. God didn't take either of them. He picked them up, brushed them off, and welcomed them. Bryce was sick. And Aaron was doing better than he ever had. And some guy chose to get in the vehicle when he was too drunk to operate it, and murdered him. That's human will. That isn't God's will. You know what God's will was? The thousands of people that were at those funerals. I came to believe this. This came to me during the sermon. That in life, when our greatest tragedies come upon us, when our greatest tragedies and heartbreaks occur, the greatest love appears. If we'll let it, we can shove it away, we can turn it off, but if we just open our hearts, it can heal. I had to testify at my father's trial. I didn't like that. I didn't like it because they told me I had to behave in court, and I'd never done that before. That was my time to make my mark, you know? And I remember going to court, and they asked me questions, and I answered them. And I remember there was some guy sitting there, had his little do going, thought he was tough. And I thought, you give me 5 minutes with him, we don't need a trial. In fact, bring all 5 of them in. That's just what I thought. But I acted better than I felt. And I left, and they convicted him. And shortly after that, God talked to me. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. I was up in Galesburg, Illinois, running Bridge Street. Bridge House on Seminary, 2265 North Seminary. I was the youngest executive director of an alcoholism and drug abuse council in the nation. That was big stuff. And God talked to me one day, and he said, "Ed, go out to California, get into show business. I'm not going to argue with God. So. Now, I would suggest this, that if you get a message from God, run it by your sponsor. Sponsors are wonderful God filters. So just, I remember one particular time I got a message from God and I ran it by my sponsor and he said, you know, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting, you know? So I went out to California where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. You know, 2.5 years sober, no sponsor, not many meetings. I was goofy, you know. And I never actually started that job. I went up to Los Angeles and went to a meeting that was full of active people that I choose to be around to this day, people who are seeing what they can do for somebody else instead of pondering their navel in meetings, wondering how they're going to figure out their situation today. And they were just shakers and movers, man. They were getting it done. And there was some guy up there. I saw him that week, and I went up the next week. And I hadn't had a sponsor up to this time because I didn't feel I was worth it. I didn't want to bother any of you guys with it, men or women with it. And I went up there the next week, and there was this guy. And I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. Well, I kind of knew the A&A rules, you know, yeah. And then he said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. Ha, ha, ha. And I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. That'll make me feel real nice. You know? And then he said, come up to me, and he stuck out his hand, and he said, if you agree to do what I tell you to do, I'll be glad to be your sponsor. And my name's Clancy. And he shook my hand, and I'm forever grateful I didn't hear some of the crap that goes around about him, whether it be true or not. And I'll tell you why. I would have heard that crap, I would have listened to you, and I would have died. Gossip's powerful, man, especially to new people who are listening to you. You're the only example they may ever see. You know, I would have, just as Bill appeared for Bob to get him to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe with every part of my soul and being, Clancy was put in front of me so I could find Alcoholics Anonymous and become emotionally sober. And man, from that point on, I try not to put down any group or individual in AA. I may not like what they're doing, but they may be the answer to your sobriety, and I want you to have that choice. And I'll tell you something, if you're hanging around somebody that's gossiping, you're the next topic, as soon as you leave. And if you got a sponsor that does that, change sponsors. Because they'll kill you. They'll kill you with that nonsense. It may sound strong, but it's been what I've experienced. So I try not to do that. I try to give you the right to be wrong and the right to be right. And I'm really glad there's a lot of different ways to do this. And all I can share with you is the way I did it. Clancy insisted I do things. Oh, man, we're running out of time. How are we doing over there? Fine? Okay. Clancy insisted I do things that made no sense to me at all. He said, at that time, the Pacific group was small. It was only about 400 people. And he said, I want you to go in there and shake all their hands. I said, I don't like them people. He said, they don't like you either. Go shake their hand. Hi, I'm Ed. Hi, I'm Ed. I'm Ed. You know? And oddly enough, since then I've traveled all over the world walking into rooms of strangers in business and in Alcoholics Anonymous and other situations where I walk up to total strangers and am quite comfortable saying, hi, I'm Ed, and you're... I thought he was being mean and he was telling me something I never knew, and that's how to fit in. I love him. I have a lot of respect for him because I found out some years ago he didn't care too much for me. And I loved him even more. This isn't a popularity contest. We sponsor people who need sponsoring, whether we like him or not. And what a wonderful example he is, because I know the kind of time I ask of him. And he never let it show. I think he feels differently now. Don't ask him. But he taught me things like, I'll never forget, one day I was broke living in L.A. and he come up and shook my hand and he was slipping me $5 for food. And he slipped it to me and when he walked away, I said, "Oh, excuse me, I can't take this." And Clancy, those of you who know him, turned around in his kind and loving way and said, "Shut up! Why don't you just shut up? Why does it always have to be about you? Why do you have to destroy the spirit of the giver? Just simply say thank you and shut up." And I said, "Well, I hadn't thought about it that way." And to this day, I say thank you. There was a few years back, about 2 years ago, I had started a little place of my own, and I was in deep trouble financially. And I made a deal with God that I wouldn't ask any human beings for money a while back. So I wasn't about to do that. And I'm sitting there, and somebody comes to see me and says, "Ed, can I talk to you?" And I said, "Sure, come on in." And they were talking for a while, and they said, "If God told you to do something, would you do it?" And I said, "Absolutely." And they said, "Well, would you do it all the way, or would you do it halfway?" And I said, "I'd do it all the way. If I knew God said it to me, and it says in 86, 87, 88, we're going to have a direct communication." I said, "If he told me to do it, I'd do it all the way." She said, "Okay, there is a check under your desktop there for $500, and I'm going home to get $500 more because God told me to give you $1,000. Now, she had no way of knowing that the total amount of my bills that day that were due and everything was being shut off was $998.70. And tears came to my eyes, and I looked at her, and I said, "Thank you." And I kept my mouth shut. And she said, "You're welcome." 2 weeks later, she came back and said, "Can I talk to you, Pastor Ed?" And I said, "Sure, come on in." And I said, "How can I help you?" She said, "I just wanted to say thank you." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "For just saying thank you. I always wanted to be a giver, but people made it so hard. So I just try to say thank you today." Another thing I try to do is honor everybody's presence that comes in contact with me. I really do. I want you to know how special you are. Somebody said we're average, but you got to understand, being a human being as average is an incredible human being. I really believe that we're all unique unto ourselves. A friend of mine, Scott, down in Nashville, I go to visit him, and I was going to speak at the prison there, and we stopped at this Burger King to get a cup of coffee, and there was a lady there. And Scott said, "Would you get me a cup of coffee?" And she got the coffee, came back, and it was a hot, sticky day. It was down in Nashville, a little humid. And this gal come back with this cup of coffee. And Scott said to her, "I want to thank you so much for coming to work today and getting that coffee for me. You made my life easier. I really enjoyed being here. Thank you." And I looked at her, and her mood just lifted. And I thought, how much does that cost? And everybody who's waited on me, I have said, "Thank you. You've done an excellent job. I appreciate you being here." Because they are my equals. And I don't ever want to forget that. I don't ever want to forget that. I went to a meeting by accident in Pasadena, California. Went over there to talk, and right before I went over there to talk, I'd started all over with God. My first honest prayer was, "God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so." That was it. But that's where I needed to start. If you want a relationship with God, get honest with Him. And if you don't quite buy it, He's fine with that. Start there, is my advice to you. And I caught myself doing that little con about maybe getting a job at that meeting, and I got down and I said a prayer and I asked God to save me from my own nonsense and let me share the miracle He's performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "I want absolutely nothing from these people." I said that exact same prayer tonight before I came downstairs. I went to that meeting, and a guy came up to me after that meeting, said, "This makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job." And I said, "Makes perfect sense to me." And he said, "Have you ever been in Taiwan?" I said, "No." He said, "Have you ever been in show business management?" I said, "No." He said, "Be in my office Monday morning." I went to his office Monday morning. On Thursday, that following Thursday, I was on a jet going out of Los Angeles International Airport going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was the new soon-to-be vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 62. I was flying to Taiwan to negotiate with the Taiwanese government a contract to build the ice rink and living arrangements while flying back and forth to Hong Kong with designer Bill Campbell to build the costumes. How was your week? You see, that's how powerful my God is. My life can change like that if I'm willing to go forward. But you know the biggest thing? Somewhere along the lines, you talked me into dropping the ones about the world and about me. You got me convinced that I'm one of God's kids and I have the right to be here. And my God died for all my ones. And continues to every day. And then when things like that happen, glorious things like that happen, I don't go, oh, I don't deserve it. I say, thank you, God. And when I'm getting my butt kicked by life, I say, thank you, God. Because when the greatest of sadnesses occurs, the greatest love appears. And I'm grateful for that. I met a lovely young woman, and we got married. She was wealthy, Muslim, daughter of the Turkish ambassador. I thought, well, our backgrounds are a lot alike. This should work. And we fought for 10 years. We're about out of time, aren't we? Okay. We fought for 10 years, had 3 children, and I love those children with all my heart, and I'm just have to tell you tonight that they think I'm the most disgusting thing that's ever walked this earth to this day. And I don't tell that to you with any pride. It just happens to be a fact. But I can also tell you this, that I have done everything in my power to be the best father I can be. And what a freedom that is. What a freedom that is. You know, too many people say, when I get all this together, then I'll be happy. When my life's together, when I have the relationship, when I have the job, when I have this. You know what? I have found you can be happy right now regardless of what's going on. It's up to you and it's up to me and it's up to God. And as long as I want to hang on to it, He'll let me. He'll just let me. 18 years sober, I lost everything I owned and I went back to Davenport, Iowa. I made a decision based on self that cost me everything. It was based on greed and it was based on money. They offered me $14,000 a month. At that time, it was decent money. And not bad now, actually. And I made a deal to get that money, and I lost everything. Now, I need to tell you, the greatest thing about that is I never got mad at me, and I never blamed anybody else. I made a mistake, and it was okay. Try not to do that ever again, but it's okay. And I moved back to Iowa. I was down here, and I went on a Christian retreat, a weekend retreat, and I had a spiritual awakening. I hadn't planned on it. Wasn't in my 5-year plan. Well, thank God I don't have 5-year plans. And I had a spiritual awakening, and what I mean by that is I had a spiritual experience so deeply that it changed my heart and my mind from that moment to this. And I am not the same person that went to that retreat. And I also know that it's not unique unto me, that it can happen to anybody who ever wants it to happen to. And that was at 23 years sober, and I kept saying, well, I've got it of the educational variety. Hang in there, guys, gals. Maybe of the spiritual experience variety, too. And it just changed me. And I loved it. Peace and calm came over me. I remember sobbing, deep sobs, because I had underestimated the power of God so much in my life. Even with all the blessings He'd done. And He said, I want you to work for me. And I said, are you sure? This is it. Remember me? He said, yeah, you. And I've never argued. I've questioned from time to time, but I've never argued. And I went off, and then within 3 weeks, I had a church in the Methodist system. I'd never done a sermon before, but it can't be that hard. I watch them all the time. And, I'd been going to church for a long time, and I always wanted to say I like Jesus, but... I never felt that way. You know, it's funny, in AA we say, you can have any God you want. You can have a tree, you can have a stump, You can have a doorknob, you can have a sponsor, a group, about the only thing we won't allow in here is Jesus. Think about it. They're the hypocrites? I don't think so. We can have any God we choose here, whether it be Jesus, Allah, the boot, the table. Any God is welcome here, and you are more than welcome to say who it is. And if anybody gives you a hard time, give them my number. You know? I went back to school. I only had a seventh grade education. I finished my little BA, 120 hours there, that little 96-hour master's degree. So I have 230 hours of college credit, as Chuck Roach, or Chuck R., excuse me, R.R., or Cliff Roach says, I'm educated far beyond my intelligence, and I've been a pastor of a church for a number of years. However, I am questioning whether I will continue that now in the last 2 weeks. Things were really going marvelously for me. I was in the Methodist system, and we got in a new bishop, and he said, you need to make a decision, Ed. If you want to talk in AA, we had made an agreement that I could go one Sunday a month to come and talk. And that was fine. And then we got in a new bishop, and he said, no, you've got to make a decision, Ed. You either give up talking in AA, or you can be a United Methodist pastor. And I want to tell you, going in, if you're a Methodist, I love this guy. Bishop Palmer is a wonderful man. He was new. And, of course, I made the most difficult decision I've ever made. It was so difficult in one way, yet so easy in the other. And when I left, they had a roast, and 450 people showed up. And they had a roast for me, and one person got up and said, we don't want to say anything bad about Pastor Ed, even jokingly. We just want to tell him that we love him, and we thank him, and we pray for him every day, and we support what he's doing. That was 6 miles from 6th and LeClaire, where I laid in the middle of the street. If that wasn't an act of God to take me all that way, then what was it? I had a 3 years, 4 years ago, I was talking on preaching on forgiveness, and I was in the middle of a sermon one day on forgiveness, and I realized I was being a hypocrite, and I stopped. And I said, I will not preach anymore on forgiveness till I hunt up the guys that killed my father and let them know that they're forgiven. Because you know something? If you forgive them, it don't count if they don't know. 2.5 weeks later, one of the guys' sentence was overturned, much to my amazement. You want to know how well AA works? And I know some of you are really going to understand how hard this is to imagine. I could not remember the name of the guys that killed my father. Talk about a justified resentment that you could just have. I couldn't remember their names. And one guy's sentence was overturned, and they came, and when it was overturned, they said to retry him or release him right away, and the press came to me, and they said, what do you think, Pastor Ed? And I said, well, it's time to heal. It's time to forgive. It's time to get back to living. They said, well, he's been in prison since he was 17 years old. Where's he going to live? How's he going to support himself? He don't have a trade. And I said to them, well, he can come and live with me if he'd like. And they were taken back by that. And I'm not sure why. You allowed me in here. Why will you welcome me in your home? What's the difference between him and I, except the right amount of chemicals and the right situation and a few seconds and inches? There is no difference. He is my equal. And that story went around the world. It was on the front page of the New York Times, the LA Times, everywhere. 2020 called me up. Oprah's producer called me up. Said, how could you do that? And how could you tell him? Well, it's step 8 and 9, Oprah. If you're working 8 and 9, it kind of... As God would have it, a few weeks later, I was walking down that prison that my brother had served so much time in that I swore I'd never go in again. By the way, that older brother I buried after he had 3 years sober and went out and drank, and I buried him at 36. And I'm walking down that prison cell, and I walk into a room to a guy I haven't seen in 27 and a half years. Last time I saw him, I was sitting in a courtroom, and I said, give me 5 minutes with him. We don't need a trial. And I stuck out my hand, and I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum. And I'm here to tell you that God loves you and I love you. And He forgives you and so do I. And if there's anything I can ever do to add to your life, please allow me to do that. And he looked into this old-timer's eyes and he knew I wasn't kidding. There was no show here. It's all about healing. If you got something that you can't let go, leave it here. Don't let it own you anymore. Leave it here. If I can leave that there, you can leave whatever you got here. It's time to heal. And an amazing thing happened. We became friends. We started talking to one another. And they decided to retry him. Well, in Iowa, if you're in commission of a felony murder, you're guilty. You get life in prison. And I went down and I talked to the county attorney who loves me and respects me. And I asked him to reduce my friend's sentence. And he listened to me. And much to the dismay of a lot of the other families, they let him out. And I was given the privilege to go up to prison and pick him up and bring him home. Take him to a halfway house, and he was there for a while. And after doing 30 years of hard time, going in at 17, it's tough to adjust. And his attitude got a little rough, so they sent him back up, and then they sent him home again. And I was able to keep my promise, and I went up and picked him up, and I brought him into my house. And I got him some clothes, and I got him a key to his own apartment. I was able to tell him that I love him, and when life was too tough and he thought he had to go back because of all the terrible noise, I was able to hold him and tell him it's okay, man. And I was able to put my head right here. Help the madness stop. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love God, and I love being sober. Thanks for having me.